strongly influenced by the writings of a man named Charles Darwin. Freud was interested in the big picture in terms of the survival and continuation of the human species on this planet. We have to give credit where credit is due. Sigmund Freud was a physician. He was certainly fully cognizant of the fact that there are many biologically based drives and needs that we have that are infinitely more important in terms of the survival of the person than the sex drive, in terms of the overall functioning of the body. I guess there's a point in all of our lives when we doubt that seriously, but looking at the big picture, things like hunger and thirst and bodily elimination and maintaining a constant body temperature and oxygen to breathe and all of those things are much more important than the sex drive. But, says Freud, there is no more important biologically based drive or need that we have in terms of the survival of humankind than the sex drive, because it ensures procreation, bringing new life into the world, and the continuation of the human species. Therefore, says Freud, looking at the big picture in an evolutionary sense, the sex drive has to be the most important one in terms of the survival of mankind, even though other drives are more important in terms of the survival of a particular individual. So he calls them psychosexual stages of development. I have a couple of general things I want to say about them before we proceed to talk about them. Number one, here's what you need to know. These stages, according to Freud, are universal. And they are invariant. By universal, I mean we all go through all of them. Invariant means that we all go through them in the same sequence or the same order. Third, under normal conditions, we go through them at roughly or approximately the same age. But it varies from person to person because of their life circumstances. Second thing I want to mention is that Freud was a very first, because of his background and spending years as a researcher in the field of biology and neurology, Freud was a very meticulous observer. He was an astute observer of human nature, human behavior, and human development. Remember earlier on we said that Freud was the first person to go on record as saying we weren't born with our personalities and that our personalities evolved. This is the story of that evolutionary development of everyone's personality. And Freud made the following observation, which we're going to talk a little bit about in our discussion of this particular material. Humans have a longer period of helplessness and total dependency for care than any other form of life on the planet. Most other species, when they're a few hours old or a day old or maybe 2 days old, can struggle and can stand up, can actively interact with their environment, with other members of their species in order to obtain their own nourishment. Babies can't. Because of the immaturity of their nervous system, their skeletal system, and their muscular system, and their inability to communicate their needs, there is nothing that a human infant can do to meet its own needs in order to ensure its survival, except cry. And for that reason, it has to enter into a special relationship with an adult caregiver who is there to provide for the needs of that infant and the survival of the infant. We put great pressure on women for the survival of offspring. If somebody's child dies, the first person we look at and look at their behavior, well, why wasn't the baby adequately cared for? Why wasn't somebody there to take care of it? So ordinarily, though not always, it's the maternal caregiver who's involved in anticipating and meeting the needs of the child. The child can only cry. It's the adult caregiver that develops an educated ear and can tell the difference between a hungry cry and a tired cry and a sick cry and a painful cry or an angry cry. So Freud says our interaction with that person is extremely important. And the farther back we go, the more important it becomes. So we'll talk a little bit about that. Freud also observed the infant from another perspective. Freud was the first person to come up with the idea that the process of human development is a process that, as it goes along, it slows down. It decelerates rather than accelerates. He believed that the most rapid period of human development occurs earliest on in life. He was right, he just didn't know how right he was. The most rapid period of human development occurs prenatally, prenatal development. During the first trimester after conception, the average human embryo increases and multiplies its size and its mass by 6.5 million times. If prenatally we continue to develop at that rate of speed, by the time we were born, the average person would weigh 160 pounds at birth. A very memorable occasion for all of our mothers, I'm sure. So luckily for them, it's a process that slows down. If we continue to grow and develop at that rate of speed, then by the time we were all 21 years of age, the average human being would be as large as our present solar system. So it's a decelerating process. Freud was just looking at what happens from birth on. He wasn't looking at prenatal development. We were not that far along in terms of our knowledge yet. But Freud made this observation that during the first 12 to 18 months of life, every person doubles their height and triples their weight. He also observed that the most highly developed portion of the human infant, when it is born, is the head. And that we develop from the head down. On the board, that's designated as cephalocaudal development. The Greek word for head is cephalus. Cephalocaudal means we develop from the head down. The size of an infant's head constitutes 1/3 of its overall body size. It constitutes 1/7 or 1/8 of a normal human adult's overall size. The head is where the brain is located. It's where most of the special senses of the body are located that are essential to our adaptive survival and interacting with the environment. So he says we develop from the head down. He says that while we're developing from the head down, our awareness of ourselves and our bodies also proceeds from the head down. So the last thing that little babies discover are their feet and toes, and they lay in the crib and play with them for hours until they're finally convinced that it's a part of their body. Second thing you see on the board, and this is going to continue later on, but right now we have a momentary pause. Up to this point, everything we have talked about in Freud's theory, and many things we are going to talk about in Freud's theory, come in threes. Suddenly he presents us with five stages of development. Hold the fort. There's a dotted line between the first three and the last two. The reason for that is, Freud tells us, it's the first three that are most important. They are the ones that are the most critical stages of development. The first three stages. In fact, he specifically refers to those, as you see here, as the pregenital stages of development. Freud says those are the most important ones because the basis for those first three stages is biological. There is a biological basis for those stages. This is the biological basis. Freud, as a researcher, in his laboratory at, or the laboratory he worked in the Department of Anatomy and Physiology at the university, made a discovery. One of several major discoveries that he made as a researcher before he left to go into practice. And the discovery was that among all the specimens and all the species that he studied, every biological organism has as a part of its anatomy certain regions of the body that have an overabundance of extremely sensitive receptor neurons. Nerve cells that are particularly sensitive to stimulation. So that when the skin or the tissue or the mucous membrane in that part of the body is stimulated, it produces very pleasurable sensations for the organism. The first three stages of our development, says Freud, center around one of those regions. He gave those regions a name. He calls them erogenous zones of the body. And the first three stages are biologically based, each of them centering around a particular erogenous zone of the body. What about the last two? Well, Freud said that he doesn't mean to suggest that nothing happens in the last two stages. He says what happens in the first three is critical, and it's most important, and the basis for it is biological. Therefore, given Freud's orientation, it's most important. The basis for the change in development that occurs in stage four and stage five is psychological, not biological. So he says in stage four and stage five of development, there will be changes in the complexity, the maturity, and the sophistication of our personality and our character structure, but not changes in the basic structure that we see occurring in stages 1, 2, and 3. So, changes based on a different reason, either psychological, emotional, social, or interpersonal, and changes in the structure in terms of its maturity or sophistication, but not the basic makeup of the personality for the character. That's the meaning of the terms over on the left side of the board. Talk a little bit about this. I gave you a handout. You have a list of the stages. You have the overview of psychoanalytic theory, which goes into them in detail, but it doesn't go into them the way I'm going to go into them in class. So if it is your judgment, then you can read the material that was distributed to you in class and go over those stages in the overview of psychoanalytic theory and survive your next test. If you believe that, there's a bridge in Brooklyn that I'm interested in selling you. If you want to talk about the asking price, I'll be glad to discuss it with you. This is what you need to know. First of all, there's material already on the board that isn't in that handout. Freud tells us this is the sequence. These are the stages. These are the approximate ages. But because the first three stages are biologically based and more complex and sophisticated in terms of their makeup than the last two, the first three stages are further divided into two phases. Early phase, later phase. Each one comprising, in the case of the first two, 9 months, for a total of 18 months of each stage. So we have phases of the stages, and something different happens in each phase. Something different happens in each stage. Each one contributes something different to our basic personality makeup. He gives each of those phases a name. I just want to clarify a couple of things. The first phase of the first stage is referred to by Freud in two ways. Early on in his writing and for much of his career, he referred to it as the dependent phase. The phase of development in that oral stage that is characterized by, in Freud's words, complete and total helplessness and dependency on another for survival. Before we are born, we are part of another organism living in the intrauterine environment for 9 months, living in a symbiotic relationship. After we're born, that relationship doesn't change. We are still totally dependent on that other person for survival. Later in his career, he used another term, the incorporative phase, in an effort to underscore the fact that that first phase is largely concerned with getting, with receiving, with taking in, with obtaining stuff from the environment, particularly that other person. Nourishment, love, affection, protection, care, etc. So the incorporative phase means that we're largely taking in stuff from outside. And two things are happening. Number one, consciousness is developing. Number two, the ego is developing. The unconscious and the id are already present when we're born. So that's what he means, incorporating, taking in from the outside world. He said, in that first phase, every human infant must enter into a special relationship. He calls it a dyadic relationship. Please note, a dyad is a two-person group, a relationship entered into exclusively by two people, the infant and the responsible adult caregiver. Not three people, not a group of people, one person who assumes responsibility for the care of that infant. Freud said, that one relationship is extremely important because it's what develops our capacity to enter into a very close, intimate relationship with another human being, characterized by trust and affection and genuine intimacy. If we don't have that one relationship with somebody and we're bounced from place to place and from person to person, we never develop that ability to trust the other person. We don't have that one consistent person in our lives that we know we can always count on, who will always be there when we are in distress or when we need something. So that's the dyadic relationship. He says, within that dyadic relationship, the functioning of that human infant is characterized by what he calls anaclitic dependency. Do yourself a favor, spell that word right. It's going to come back to haunt you later on in our discussion of Freud's theory, so get it right the first time. A-N-A-C-L-Y-T-I-C. It means total dependency, total helplessness for survival, dependency on the other. Introjection. Between birth and 2 weeks of age. Once that baby comes into this world, that adult caregiver, as a result of such activities as feeding and dressing and bathing and diapering and changing and rocking and holding and talking to, providing a tremendous amount of stimulation to the surface of the body through the largest sense organ we have, the skin, through sound, through sight, through smell, that person who's caring for the infant bombards that infant with an incredible amount of external stimulation. We are born with an unconscious, we are born with an id, and through ministering to that little baby to take care of it and protect it and nourish it, what happens is that that external stimulation redirects the interest and attention of the infant away from what's going on inside its body. Is it hot, tired, is it hungry, is it sleepy, is it sick, what have you, to redirecting that interest and attention toward the outside environment. And that person who is caring for the infant, says Freud, listen carefully, is the first representative of society. First representative of the outside world. That is the first interpersonal relationship we ever enter into. That person becomes associated with the following. Warmth, comfort, satisfaction, stimulation, and the whole gamut of experiences that we have when we are very young, when we are in early infancy. Therefore, says Freud, that person becomes the central focus of the infant's attention. When that baby is awake and that person enters the room, all eyes are on that person. They are the gravy train. They're the one who satisfies all the needs of the infant. Once they become the central focus, we're getting there. Once we become the central focus, that person becomes the central focus of the infant's attention. What that person then does, says Freud, is to begin to redirect the interest and attention of the infant away from herself or himself toward everything else and everyone else in the environment. Pointing out things, talking about things, describing things, explaining things. This is a rattle, and this is your bottle, and that's your father, and that's your sister, and that's a dog, and this is a toy. Freud said that other person, right from the get-go, becomes, and this is a quote,
the interpreter of reality to the child. That person's perceptions become the child's perception. What the child does is to take in or to take on to itself that person's outlook, that person's perception, that person's feelings. And don't touch that, you might get hurt, and leave that alone. And this is okay to have. The process is called introjection. Introjection means to take what is part of someone else, an outlook, an attitude, a feeling, a belief, and incorporate it into your personality. To take on someone else's outlooks, their belief, their value, their understanding of the world. They become the bridge between the infant and the outside world and interpret and describe and explain everything. So they establish, says Freud, the child's basic outlook on life. Pardon? Reality. Which definition? To take on that which is a part of somebody else and incorporate it into your psychological makeup. To take on their attitudes, their feelings, their beliefs, their standards, and make it yours. So what's happening here? That person is actually stimulating the development of the child's ego, their sense of self, how they feel about themselves is a reflection. Freud says, you don't learn to love unless you feel loved, and that goes for you as well. If that person makes you feel liked and loved and accepted, you must be pretty okay, so you'll learn to like and accept yourself. Other things are learned. If the child cries and that adult caregiver comes and patiently and lovingly and attentively responds to that little child's needs when it cries, that child is learning. There is something they can do to help themselves when they're in distress or when they're uncomfortable or in a state of need. They can cry and bring that other person to them, and they learn that that's a consistent thing. If they cry, that person will come and help. If a child expresses its hunger by crying and the adult ignores the child and that baby cries itself to sleep, it's learning something very different. No matter what kind of distress or discomfort you're in, if you express that, nothing's going to happen. The world is an inconsistent, unpredictable place in which you can't tell from one moment to the next what's going to happen to you. They learn to distrust the environment through that other person rather than learning to trust the environment through that other person. So very different outlooks and attitudes toward the environment around us are established fairly early on. Let's take a look at that first stage, the oral stage, dependent phase, or incorporative phase, whichever you prefer. Yes?
That's the early phase, you said, is dependent.
Right there, number one. First 6 to 9 months of life. In Freud's view, in that first phase of life, the oral region is the primary zone of contact. The mouth is the primary zone of contact between the infant and the external environment. Obtaining nourishment. Taking in, incorporating. But Freud said it goes beyond that. So many of life's early functions in that first stage center around the mouth. The first social response that a human being makes to another human being is the smile. First sign of affection between human beings, the kiss. 5.5 months, the acquisition of one's first tooth makes a different kind of feeding possible. Self-feeding, finger food. Somewhere between 9 and 12 months. It can be later than that. It can be anywhere between 9 and 15, but for most little kids, it's between 9 and 12, anywhere in there. First spontaneous one-word utterance, interpersonal communication, psycholinguistic development, the mouth. So many important developmental milestones in that first 18 months of life.
involve the mouth. Freud calls it the oral stage of development. Now, we have to make sure that we're on the same page here. I could go through and describe the things that happen in terms of physical development during the stages, and we would totally miss the point of what Freud is driving at. What he's interested in is what are the psychological changes that occur, what are the personality characteristics that develop, what are the character traits that develop in each phase of each stage. Let's take the first phase of the first stage. To allow yourself to let somebody else get close to you. Freud said it's important that every child be a part of a close, warm, affectionate, intimate relationship with another human being. One constant person in the child's life. Doesn't have to be the mother. Can be the grandmother, can be an aunt, can be an adoptive parent, can be the father. One person. Ongoing. Over time. Not multiple parenting. One caregiver. That's what develops the capacity for making that kind of connection. The capacity to love and allow yourself to be loved by another, to allow yourself to be taken care of by another. What happens? Passivity, submissiveness, allowing yourself to be cared for. So tendencies to seek help, to seek protection, to seek care, to seek guidance and direction from another person, to seek someone else's help when you're in need of assistance. Those are all characteristics, says Freud, that develop during the first phase of the first stage. Help seeking, nurturance seeking, to seek protection and care from another. To receive, to get. So he says we start out life using somebody else in order to meet our needs, and we get better and more sophisticated at it as we get older. That's the bottom line. Dependency needs. That's the key word, key phrase, dependency. Passive, submissive, dependent. I've said to you before that at this stage of your development, what you have to think about is the fact that in this phase, at this stage, there is absolutely nothing that you can have, hold, touch, look at, play with, or consume that isn't given to you by that other person. You don't go anywhere unless you're transported by that other person, being carried on their hip or pushed in a stroller. Something very important happens with phase two. And before I get there, let me just tell you, do not interpret his use of the word aggressive in today's vernacular language. Watch out for so-and-so, they're really aggressive. That's not what he's talking about. If you substitute the phrase, and the smart ones will jot this down, self-assertive for the word aggressive, it means something closer to what Freud is talking about. Yes. It is in this stage, beginning somewhere between 6 and 9 months, that every child acquires their own ambulatory skills, their own locomotion skills. They can get around on their own. No longer do they have to be carried from place to place. You put them down and they take off. They have learned to roll over on their stomach, get up on their hands and knees, and propel themselves around. Creeping, crawling, standing, pulling themselves into a standing position. Now, says Freud, by aggressive, they can more actively and vigorously explore the environment on their own. They don't need somebody to do it for them. Much greater independence and autonomy. So in the aggressive phase, put in your notes, that's when every person, as an infant, begins to take their first steps toward more autonomous and more independent functioning. More vigorous exploration of the environment, and that's where the problem begins.
just when you can get down on the floor and crawl over to the table, pull yourself into a standing position, and get your grubby little hand out on that glass candy dish that's been sitting on the end table all these months, that shines so brilliantly when the sun shines through the window on a sunny day, along comes some horse's ass, picks up the candy dish, and says, no, no, that's not for you, and puts it on the shelf where you can't reach it. Just when you can crawl across the carpet to the two steps down into the family room, where there is a toy box where your older brothers and sisters keep all the toys that they have so much fun with, some jackass comes along and puts a gate across the doorway so you can't fall down the stairs. That's got to frustrate the hell out of you. Just when you can crawl across the kitchen floor and open the cabinet doors where they keep all the pots and pans that make such great noise, somebody takes a wooden-handled spoon and sticks it through the handles of the cabinet so you can't open it. Or they put one of those new locks on, child-proof locks. So Freud said, listen carefully, just when you get this newfound sense of independence and the desire to explore the environment and learn everything and experience it on your own, that's when people start to impose limits. The imposition of external control over the child's behavior. It is actually in this second phase of the oral stage that parents frequently describe this as the beginning of the terrible twos. In psychoanalytic theory, it's known as the stage of negative independence. Parents are constantly saying to kids, now that they can get around on their own stink, no, don't do that. No, don't touch that. You're going to knock it over. No, don't do that. You're going to hurt yourself. No, you can't have that. That belongs to your brother. No, not now. You'll have to wait on this. As an infant, our needs are satisfied completely and on the spot. Now we have to learn, listen carefully, to accept partial satisfaction rather than complete satisfaction. We must learn to postpone or delay satisfaction until it's convenient for somebody else. And the most ubiquitous word in the vocabulary of the adults around the child in dealing with it when it gets to this age is no. No. Is it small wonder that one of the first words every little kid learns to say to its parents in defiance is no? Finish your supper so you can have dessert? No. Put your toys away? No. It's time to go for your nap? No. Come on, let's go for a bath? No. No, no, no. That's that negativism I'm talking about. Those are what are called oppositional tendencies. If you are going to assert yourself and your independence, you must assert yourself against someone or something, and parents are real handy for that. Oppositional tendencies. By oppositional tendencies, I mean things like stubbornness, pouting, negativism. I want that. Well, you can't have that. That's your brother, but you can have this one. Then I don't want any. Cut off your nose to spite your face. That's negativism. Please note, the child typically does it verbally. There are, however, instances where the child has the opportunity to do it behaviorally. If you've ever had the experience of trying to pick up a kid this age when they don't want to be picked up, and they turn their skeletal system into a bowl of jello so that you can't pick them up, and they just go limp. And it's like you're trying to lift a 50-pound bag of potatoes that are mashed. Yeah. That's oppositional tendencies. Take them for a walk and you hold their hand, now they can get around a little bit. One of my grandchildren has just started walking around. Went for a walk down the street to the park with her mother the other day. I was over their house visiting. And I can remember, back when my kids were young, when a child starts getting around like that, if you've got one who's got particularly strong needs for independence, you start walking them down the street and you're holding their hand and all of a sudden they manage to wiggle their hand out of yours, take off like a bat out of hell across somebody's lawn. They get halfway across the lawn and they turn around and they look at you and they laugh.
Now your heart's in your mouth, there's traffic whizzing by in the street, and the kid's standing there on somebody's lawn laughing at you. So there's several ways you can deal with that. You can say, so long, pal, I'll see you later. Turn and start walking in the other direction, and they'll be on your leg like a blanket. So if you want that kid to follow you around like a puppy dog until it's 40 years old and you have to tell it what to do every damn day, do that. Otherwise, if you want that child to become more independent and self-sufficient, chase them. Here's what's going to happen. They're going to run, but they're going to run slowly. They're going to run slowly because they want to get caught. And when you catch them, they're going to laugh like hell. They've been following you around like a puppy dog for months and months and months, and for the first time they were able to make you come to them. That's called rapprochement. That's part of that oppositional phase. Instead of going to you, bringing you to them. So Freud tells us there are certain character traits and personality characteristics associated with the development that goes on in this particular phase. Now I'm going to add something here. Passive-aggressive tendencies. Passive aggression. Most of the time that doesn't mean direct confrontation. It means to be oppositional, to be negative, to be stubborn, to pout. You get a little bit older, it means to become sarcastic. Yeah, right, sure. The perpetual chip on the shoulder. Passive-aggressive. So don't think of aggressive in the terms that we think of it today. What's really happening here is passive-aggressive trends. Passive-aggressive means an attempt on the part of someone to manipulate another person on an emotional level in order to do what they want them to do. To get somebody to do things for you without directly asking, but by manipulating them emotionally. That is passive-aggressive. It's an interpersonal style, it's an interpersonal skill, not necessarily a desirable one. Every single person sitting in this room right now, at one time or another in your life, has been exposed to the subtle, and sometimes not so subtle, emotional manipulation by another person to get them to do something they want you to do. Here's one of my personal favorites. Yeah, we have two types. We have a red one and a blue one, and nobody but a jerk would pick the blue one. Which one do you want? How about this one? I want you to know that I'm not angry. I'm just really hurt. I am really disappointed. Ever heard that one? How about, if you really loved me, you would do so-and-so. It's like getting hit with a medicine ball right in the solar plexus. Bring home a report card. 4 A's, 1 B. Somebody looks at it and says, how come you got a B? You're my kid. You're not stupid. You should get better grades. They should all be A's. Passive-aggressive. The subtle manipulation of another person emotionally to get them to comply or to conform or to do what you want them to do. More often than not, it's to get that other person to meet your dependency needs by manipulating them emotionally so that you don't have to directly ask for what you want. Yep. They got to learn it someplace. I came home from college. I was about 19 years old. I was only home for 3 days. I called up the person who at the time was my main squeeze, made arrangements to go out on a Saturday night
spent the whole damn day washing and polishing my car, went inside, took a shower, shaved, put on my best clothes, came down reeking of cologne, walked across the living room with my car keys in my hand, and my mother said to me, "So help me, oh, were you going out tonight?" And I said, because I was a smart ass, "No, Mom, I was just this way to watch TV on Saturday night. Why did you ask?" Her response, "Oh, no reason. I don't want to be a bother. You go ahead, you go out with your friends and have fun, but please drive carefully. You know how I worry about you." Mm-hmm. "Well, why did you ask?" "No, no, please, I don't want to be a bother. You go ahead and have fun, but please be careful." "Mom, why did you ask if..." "Well, I wanted to go over to Mrs. Ryan's." True story. "I wanted to go over to Mrs. Ryan's house tonight. But that's all right. You go ahead. You're only young ones. You have fun with your friends. I'll take the bus." I look at my watch and I say, "Mom, it's Saturday. The buses don't run on their regular schedule. There are no more buses. Why don't you get dressed and I'll take you?" "Oh, no, 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 please. I couldn't do that. You go ahead. I'll walk." So she said, "I'll walk." Now I've got this vision of this little old lady in my head walking down dark streets toward Mrs. Ryan's house, down near the train station before she can make a right and get to a brightly lit street with a big sign on her back saying, "Mugger's Welcome." I got my car keys in my hand. Now how the hell can I leave the house? Takes me 30 minutes of begging to get her to get dressed so I can take her to Mrs. Ryan's house. I'm 30 minutes, maybe 35 minutes late picking up my date. And there's a reason why I had a date with this person that night. Mm-hmm. And that reason is now shot right in the rear end. Because I've got to drop her off early so I can go pick up my mother at Mrs. Ryan's house and take her home. Here's the punchline. The woman has a valid New Jersey driver's license. She's the one who taught me how to drive. And there's another car registered to the Darney family parked in front of the house. But she doesn't like to drive at night. Manipulating someone else on an emotional level to get them to meet your dependency needs and do what you want without directly asking them. In fact, protesting as much as you can. Making them beg you to screw up their life. Pardon the pun. We all learn it. We acquire it. Parents use a variety of coercive and subtle techniques in socializing the child, and that's what passive-aggressive is all about. Now, here's what you need to think about. Take everything that happens in phase one. I spent a fortune on this conversation in my therapy dealing with this with my mother and her very skillful manipulative techniques. When I was in therapy, just unbelievable. The woman owes me thousands of dollars. Anyway, take what happened in phase one, what happened in phase two, and blend them together. And then you take everything that happened in both phases of this stage when you move to the next one. Because that's going to mix with everything that happens in the early and later phase of the second stage. So the personality becomes much more complex and sophisticated with each phase of each stage that we go through. It's not that one stops and the other leaves off. Freud says that traits, qualities, and characteristics we develop in each phase of each stage become a relatively permanent part of our mature personality, either to a greater or lesser degree. This is the first stage. Who's got a question? Who needs something clarified? Who needs something explained? Yes, they mix together. And then you take that mixture into the next stage. And then there's going to be two sets of different kinds of development in the next stage. You mix those together, then add them to what happened in the first stage, and you move on to the third. So our personality becomes more and more sophisticated and complex as we go along.
Does this tie into the core personality that Brody was talking about?
The what?
The core. This is part of the core personality.
Yes.
And this second, this aggressive phase, This happens between 9 and 18 months?
That's correct. It's when it begins, it doesn't end there. Because the second stage that we have is the one where for the first time we really run into conflict with society. That's when we encounter the first major socialization demands of society. And it's a hoot. Because the second stage actually has more implications for influencing our long-term personality goals and development than the first one does.
The first one kind of, well, it does. It gets us ready for the societal demands of the second stage.
Exactly. Right? I have a public service announcement for you. I would like for you to know that I'm going to be out of state on the 9th of November. So I would like you to put in your notes, this class will not meet on November 9th. Always for today. So we will meet on Tuesday, and then we won't meet again until the following Tuesday. We're making good progress in terms of this theory. Let's see what we get accomplished by next Tuesday. Then we'll probably finish it up the following week. And if I were you, I would start getting prepared. Have a great weekend. That's it for today. I'll see you next time.
I wanted to continue.